So welcome back, everyone. We're in the second hour of Narsil in Action. Hoping that we have our technical issues resolved here. For the second hour, I want to thank Ms. Kelly for agreeing to stay with us. In addition, we're going to be joined by Ms. Jennifer Burrell from New Mexico. And Andy, we are looking for an area code 575. And I haven't been able to find it yet, but that's what we're looking for. Ms. Burrell is going to be with us to take questions on Can We Do That? And we are going to take those questions that we're holding over that I mentioned that were three from the previous segment before we get into Can They Do That? But Ms. Burrell attended Case Western Reserve University School of Law, and her studies focused on international criminal law and litigation. Following graduation, she joined the district attorney's office in Clovis, New Mexico, where she spent several years prosecuting felony-level cases prior to opening her own private practice. After 9 years in private practice, Ms. Burrell joined the Santa Fe Trial Division of the Law Office of the Public Defender. She's a member of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Attorneys Board of Directors and serves on the Media Committee. This is your opportunity to ask questions about supervision demands and registry demands that you think may be unlawful. And Andy, did you have any luck locating her?
Is it 0024?
I don't believe it is. So let me take a look.
I see 1575, and that's all I see.
Unless she has stuck in with a different number, it would be ending in a 7060. So anyway, well, we will go forward with while we're waiting for her to show up. She got that fabulous introduction, and she'll be here. Anyway, we will go forward with the questions that have held over for deregistration. And I don't know if everybody heard me, but I said we're going to take them on the flip side after the break. And we're going to do that. So there was a three.
Do you want me to unmute King?
Sure. We always want King unmuted as long as he's not tearing his house down. King, are you here?
King is here.
King, welcome. And I'll introduce you. King Alexander is a regular on Narsil in Action. He is in the state of Louisiana with the Calcasieu Parish Public Defender's Office. And he's a supervising felony with a life without parole attorney, which they have in Louisiana. And Louisiana is famous for that and non-unanimous jury verdicts and some other things. But welcome, King, and glad to have you. Always glad to have you.
So I'm glad to be here.
So we were finishing up the previous segment with Ms. Kelly. There were some questions that people wanted to ask about deregistration, and we're going to take all three of them. So I'm going to do area code 239, then 847, then 812. So area code 239, you are now on Narsil in Action with your question regarding deregistration or for Ms. Kelly.
Yes, hi, thank you. I have a case that the offense date was November 21st of 1990. It's a class 4 felony out of Colorado, out of Arapahoe County. Judge Rafferty, and it's sexual assault on a child, but it's a class 4 felony. You think I may be able to deregister in Colorado?
I'm going to tell you that you are very likely prohibited and you will fall under the lifetime supervision, unfortunately. So okay. it's just okay. One of the convictions that's excluded. Every once in a while, there's something that was different about that case. You maybe pled to a lesser charge. Sometimes people are mistaken on cases that are as old as this. That might have been the charge originally, but you might have actually pled down to something different. I'm not sure. It's always worth it to have someone have a look.
Okay.
Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it does.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And I'm sorry it took so long to get to you. Thank you for the question and for the wait. We are going to now move on to area code. I forgot which order I said. I'm going to do 812. Go ahead. You're on Narsil in Action.
Hi. I have a conviction in the state of Indiana for child molestation from 1998. I was removed from the sex offender registry in June of this year by the state of Indiana. I was actually in the process, a deregistration process, and unbeknownst to me, when we started the process, my attorney checked and that I had already been removed, and he did some looking, and the state of Indiana had removed me due to the ex post facto thing that took place in the state of Indiana. My question revolves around international Megan's Law, though, since federal law shows that I should be a class 3, tier 3 sex offender, being I am I'm not on the registry in Indiana. Do I still have to do my 21-day registration? And my attorney thought that I may have to do that, but when I checked with the sheriff's department where I normally register, they said they will not take my 21-day registration. Asked me to call the marshal's office. I called the U.S. Marshal's office. They sent me to a website that didn't have any information. And then I also called the SMART office, who sent me to another website that had information that I couldn't understand. So I'm in a pickle. I don't know what to do and who to register and if I even have to do my 21-day registration.
That's actually an interesting question. I think I touched on it a little bit before on an earlier question. Here's the problem, and here's what I would caution you about, is just because someone is telling you you don't have to register, such as the sheriff's office, things like that, you want to make sure that you're getting something like that in writing, because, you know, if it comes up years later where you're supposed to actually be registering, you don't have that proof. And then the second thing I advise you to do is, I'm not sure exactly what the process is by which you were removed by Indiana. So I really think that you need to consult with an Indiana attorney to get a firm answer to that. But keep that other stuff, keep a record of it, so that if it comes back later, you have something to support the fact that at least someone told you.
So, okay, thank you.
I hope that helps you. Thank you for the question and for listening. And now we have Ms. Burl on, and she missed that fabulous introduction that I gave her. Jennifer, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Larry. Thank you.
Jennifer is my dear friend, and we had the layout of the program in Eastern time, and it was a little bit confusing, and so we've got her here now. So the glowing introduction, I'll just polish it and say that we were together a couple of weeks ago at a CLE, and Jennifer did a presentation, and I co-presented, and I'm very jealous because she got a 4.0 on a 4-point scale, and I got a 3.7.
Well, there's nobody more into this topic than you, Larry, so I don't know how that happened.
That's what I have to say.
I got a 3.7, but you remember the first session, they didn't fare so well in that one. They were quite a bit further down on the ratings, but we're so glad to have you here with us tonight. And we're gonna finish one more question on the deregistration, and then we're gonna do the can they do that, and see if we can fill this again with questions.
Right.
The next question comes from area code 847. You're now on Narcelin Action. Go ahead. Area code 847. We've kept you waiting, but now you're on. And area code 847, I will not hang up on you. I'll come back to you because I think you probably laid your phone down and gotten bored. So I'm going to mute you and going to come back to you in a couple of minutes. But okay. So we're going to everybody. We're doing this program despite the inclement terrible weather that's happening on the Eastern Seaboard, and I'm trying to get some reports from our people in that part of the country. And I'm looking for Robin. I'd like to see if we can get a report about what's going on in North Carolina. And so can you find Robin? I'm not seeing him, although I had seen him earlier on this board here.
He's listed as an active speaker. Robin, go ahead.
Yeah, Robin, can you hear
us? I'm here.
Yeah,
I can hear you.
What's the story going on in North Carolina? NARSL put out a press release about this yesterday about there's a premises restriction in North Carolina that prohibits people from seeking shelter if they're operated by a school or all these variety of things. Can you give a thumbnail of that and tell me, are people getting shelter, or are they being left to fend for themselves, the people that are on the registry? What's going on in North Carolina as this storm approaches?
Well, there's no specific statute regarding emergency shelter. There's just the general proximity statute, which is a proximity restriction of 300 feet from schools, churches with playgrounds, any place where children might congregate. So what happened was in Brunswick County, which is closer to the coast and very close to Wilmington, the sheriff there decided to they apparently hired a calling company, a robocall company out of Louisiana, of all places, to call all of the sex offenders registered in the county to inform them that should they need to seek shelter, they should not attempt to do that at a school or at a church. And at least a couple of the guys report that they were told any place where children are. So at least for those who are in that area, and the area that's most severely impacted right now, honestly, I don't think there's any shelter for them. And the people that we've spoken to who had alternative options have chosen to leave the area. One in particular we know about went to Columbia. That was before the storm decided it was going to go to Columbia too. So I feel a little bit bad about that. But that's the situation. Now, in Raleigh, we had a couple of people who were more proactive and actually contacted the sheriff's department. One of the people that I know very well, he has an elderly mother. His biggest concern was he didn't want to be separated from his mom, who may need shelter. And so he called the sheriff's department, asked what he could do. And the sheriff's department said it would be perfectly fine for him to drop his mother off at the shelter. And then he could go to the jail and keep in touch with her by phone.
Assuming the phones work. That's fabulous, Robin. That's really fabulous. I saw a press account today that they're making sure that they got shelters for animals, and that's a big issue because animals will get stranded. But there seems to be no concern to get shelter for human beings. And in fact, they're trying to do what they do in the wintertime, which is to prohibit them from having shelter because of the registration status. I mean, that speaks something about where we are in America.
I had the opportunity earlier today to speak to a reporter with WRAL, which is one of the major stations here in the Raleigh market. And I didn't know what I would receive. I didn't know what kind of attitude he might have. But I began to make my case, and he asked me, what is it that you guys want? And I told him, well, what we want is for everybody to be treated fairly and for everybody to have access to shelter. And his response was, well, what if something happens? You know, it only take one incident and everybody's head will roll. And my response to him at that point was simply to say, well, you know, the fact of the matter is these shelters are going to be full of every variety of felon you can imagine. Many of them will have backgrounds and records, not to disparage those folks. They all need shelter. But it's just this particular class of people who have nowhere to go.
It's
sad.
It's tragic. How many hours are you guys from the eye wall making landfall?
The last report suggests that it should make landfall in the morning, sometime between 7 and 8. Raleigh is about an hour and a half from Wilmington, but again, it's no longer on a path here. We should only experience some intolerable winds and quite a bit of rain, but nothing severe like the folks on the coast are going to be dealing with these next few hours. So it's actually for the next 2 or 3 days is what they're saying.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the update. We are now to can they do that? This is my fun program. And I'm hoping that we have a little bit of fun tonight and provide a service to people. The disclaimer has been given already. Keep in mind that the responses provided on the program are merely intended to offer guidance and should not be construed as binding legal advice. There is no attorney-client privilege, and we cannot cover specifics of any individual situation sufficiently to know what might be the best course of action. And having said that, anybody who thinks they might want to ask a question about something that's being done, wondering if they can do that, go ahead and hit star six and get in the queue. And I'm going to bat a few around here that are common while we're waiting for the queue to fill. And both of you guys can take these. And King, you can jump in here also. You're going to have something to offer about the internet, but I'm going to jump to another question. This one I just got a couple of days ago. I live at my mom's house, and now they've done told me that that she can't even have booze in the house. She's not on probation. How can they tell me that my mother can't have an alcoholic beverage in her own house? Can they do that?
Yes. I mean, because if you have access to the alcohol in your home, then yes, they can control what's available to you in your house. They can restrict anyone who's living in your house, basically. So you have the choice to live somewhere else or have everyone in the house comply. So this would be similar to like a felon who's not allowed to have a gun. And so nobody in the house can have a gun because then they'd have access to it.
And that sounds like Ms. Burrell. Is that you?
Yes, it is.
Yes. You're not on
very interesting.
You're not on the Discord connection because we couldn't get a headset to you in time. So it sounded like it was you, but okay. So did you have anything to add, Colleen? Or are you good with that answer that we've heard?
No, I agree. I mean, they can't technically tell your mother what to do. She can do whatever she wants in your own house. It's the point at which you live with that person where they can make those restrictions.
So that's a very common question that it's not the first time I've gotten it. It's usually something similar to that about, can they prohibit my housemate from having X, Y, and Z? This time it's alcohol. Sometimes it's a weapon. Sometimes it's, we can go on and on. But the answer is, in all those circumstances, they really can't prohibit the mother from having the alcohol, but they can certainly prohibit you from living there, can't they? If you can't comply with the requirements that a person not have access to those prohibited items. Okay, let's do a couple more. I have a condition. They just told me that I can't have internet access at all. I mean, don't you have to have internet to function in a modern society? How can you apply for jobs? How can you follow the classifieds? How can you go on Craigslist? How can you do all these things? How can you pay your bills? I can't have internet access at all. Can they do that? Can they while I'm under supervision?
Yes, this is Jennifer again. Yes, absolutely they can. They can restrict your access. Sometimes if there's a special need, like to apply for a job or something like that, you can get permission to go to like a public library and submit your application, but you need to have that cleared through your supervising officer so that you're not in violation. But yeah, absolutely, because there's so much access to chat rooms or photographs or pornography or different things like that, they can definitely restrict your access to the internet.
Can they totally prohibit it? Can they say no access, or should they narrowly tailor it to where that it would be highly structured? Can they just say you don't get on the internet, period?
Well, and that's what I was saying. I think if you have something specific that you need to do that you can't do without the internet, then I think you can request permission to do that. And if they deny that, then go to the court and make it more narrowly tailored. But generally, yes, they can prohibit your access across the board. You would need to apply for permission to do anything like apply for a job or anything of that nature, maybe, you know, banking, if your bank doesn't have like a brick and mortar store, those kind of things. But you would have to get specific permission as an exemption from the generic blanket from the internet.
Well, folks, we want you to get star six, get in the queue. There's already a couple in there. I'm going to take that looks like they're from Colorado. These may be registration questions. So let's go to area code 303. You're on Narcel in Action.
Hi, my husband is a class 5, and he got 2 years of probation. Immediately, like the first day he went in there, they said, well, 2 years, that's hardly enough time to get through our program. And then his probation officer said the other day to him, well, this may take, you know, we may need to add on another 3 or 6 months to get through all the stuff we want. And my husband's complied with everything. He's been to you know, every session they wanted him to do. They kind of are the ones that were slow poking it to begin with. Can they do that?
I can answer this question.
I think it would depend on what state you're in. And so if they haven't been able to comply with the terms of the probation, I know in New Mexico we have a special 5 to 20, probation. They could ask the court to extend it so that just enough to meet the terms of your probation requirement. But here I think it would be hard to not meet them within 5 years.
Okay, but we're in Colorado. What I'm saying is they, from the very beginning, said 2 years was not enough for their program. And that's what the judge gave him, was 2 years. He's complied with everything they've asked. It's them that's kind of slow poking it and claiming they can't possibly get through their program, whatever that may be, in 2 years. It's not a matter of my husband complying. He's doing everything they've asked him to do.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with Colorado law. Perhaps the Colorado attorney could answer that for you.
Okay, so this is something that's actually kind of common in Colorado. And what they do is they determine the length of probation, right? So in this case, that's 2 years. But they also, as part of the agreement, say in those 2 years, one of the requirements of probation is to, quote unquote, finish or complete satisfactorily sex offender treatment. And then at the end of the 2 years, frequently they're saying, well, that just wasn't enough time. We still need more treatment. So you're kind of stuck. And it comes down to, it wasn't the greatest way to word a plea agreement because it creates this impossibility. So he has a choice of agreeing to extend it so he has more time to fulfill the requirement, or making the argument that he shouldn't really have to extend it. So what they kind of do is they kind of bully them into accepting that extension. And you certainly want to tread lightly, though, because you don't want to have the judge violate him because he hasn't completed things. But that's something where you want to hire an attorney in there to represent him and kind of make the argument that he's fulfilled the requirements and they can't extend it.
Okay, well, and I practice only in Louisiana now. I'm a member of the bar also in Texas and California, but in terms of this law, I'm only familiar with Louisiana, and I can tell you that the procedure here would be that it would be incumbent on the probation and parole. Now, you're talking about a probationer, correct? And your husband was given 2 years probation. And now his minders say that to complete the program that he's required to complete requires more than 2 years. Well, first of all, I'll say that's a travesty in itself. If they can't do what they needed to do in 2 years, something is wrong with them. But even so, here, I can tell you in my jurisdiction, Louisiana, they would have to apply to the judge to extend that probation. The judge would hear it, and the judge would have the power to say, well, this man has done everything you've asked for him for 2 years. I gave him a 2 year probation, and I'm going to release him from this. I don't know what state laws there may be that would say that the law that the judge, is butting heads with something perhaps bigger than he or she on that issue. It's in terms of being able to pressure him to agree to it, they might have a fair amount of leverage in Colorado. And those who are more familiar with Colorado seem to be cautioning that kind of an approach. But I don't know how they extend probation without applying to the judge who said it in the first place.
Well, King, I can respond to that. The way that they don't just extend the probation. What they do is, right at the end of the term, they file a complaint for revocation of probation and say that he hasn't fulfilled the requirements. So similarly, if someone was required to complete 100 hours of community service and they hadn't.
So that strikes me as Animal Farm kind of stuff. I mean, it would be to be proactive on behalf of a client. I might apply to the judge in advance of the end of the 2 years and say, look, judge, they're threatening to revoke me if I haven't completed their program by the end of the 2 years you gave me. And they've set it up so that it can't be completed within the 2 years. So
Can we address this now so that I'm not in danger of a revocation at the end of the 2 years? I don't know where the lady said they stood right now in terms of the time frame.
And so basically
is that a mechanism that could be feasible in Colorado to outfox them and get there first?
I mean, as I was sort of commenting on before, and is the problem is really with the initial plea agreement that, you know, that's not necessarily a plea agreement that I would have advised my client to enter into because I know that this has happened. So essentially, you know, that requirement that you complete something within that time period, knowing that a lot of times they come back and they say, oh, hey, this person hasn't quote unquote completed it. You know, I would have it worded, participate fully during the time period, and then they can't do that. But going back, it's just having an attorney advise you and going through as opposed to just, you know, refusing to deal with it or agreeing to extend it. Again, there's a little bit of bullying of people, you know, saying, hey, well, we're going to revoke you unless you agree to extend it. If you don't agree to extend it, we're going to file this motion to revoke, and kind of getting in before it comes to that is what you need to be doing, I think.
We're going to be talking about plea agreements in the third hour, and this will be a good thing for people to, because Ms. Burrell and I are going to really try to dig a little bit deeper into plea agreements. But caller, thank you for that, and we're going to move on because there are people in the queue. And stay with us. Area code again, 303. It's your turn on Darcelin Action. Go ahead.
Hi, is it okay if I respond to the lady with her husband on 2 years of probation?
I think that would be delightful as long as it's appropriate. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it's just advice. I had more than 15 years of probation in Colorado about 5 years ago, successfully completed it. At the end of the probation, they decided that wasn't long enough and that also I failed a polygraph. And being on probation in Colorado, everything is based on the polygraph. Your whole life is based on the polygraph. And so what happens is that if they're upset with something you did or you failed the polygraph, 90% of the people at the end of their term, they will scare them into signing an extension. And so they do it so-called, quote, their free will to sign this document saying that they agree to a four-year extension or whatever, a probation. And if they don't sign that extension, they will be revoked and go to prison.
That almost sounds like duress.
is crazy in more ways than I can begin to know how to describe. If I can explain myself, in Texas, they do 10-year probations. I never heard of a 15-year probation. In Louisiana, it can only go 5. And so right off the bat, this sounds pretty bizarre to me. I've seen them extended to allow people to pay restitutions, but now there's been reforms that says when you get to the end of probation, you don't extend it because of that. It just converts to a civil judgment. But and also, I know New Mexico is different. In New Mexico, polygraph is admissible in court. But to base the whole thing on the polygraph, and some parts of Louisiana use them, probation and parole who supervise registrants use them, and others don't, and some use voice stress analyzers, VSA. But it's bizarre to me that everything your whole life is determined by polygraph and is not even admissible at a trial. So there's so many things weird about that. But I guess we're talking about can they do that, and it always comes back to they can do it until we stop them. And that requires being proactive and asserting the Constitution, and it's not easy.
I'm thanking you for that call. Did you have anything else? I muted you prematurely. Did you have anything else? Okay, I think he's got too much background noise. Thank you for that call. All right, Can they do that? And unfortunately, that turns out to be our answer on this program, is they can do it until they're stopped. And what we're trying to focus in on, everybody, is we're not trying to be flippant. We're trying to zero in on things that, if it was properly framed with the right resources, that it could be stopped. Some things can't be stopped. They have complete authority to do that. And the case law, the statutory law supports them. But there are some things that are not so well grounded, but they do that because the only thing that stops you from doing something is your own personal morals or a higher authority by court, issued by court. And sometimes in the case of Joe R. Pyle, that doesn't even stop him. But so the question, and then he gets away with it, he gets a pardon. But we're not trying to be flippant at all when we say they can do it until they're stopped. We're trying to figure out what causes of action we might can zero in on and refer you to yes, you think you should contact someone. This is egregious, or no, you probably would not get anywhere with that challenge. That's really the point of can they do that? It's not to be flippant about it, because they can do anything until they're stopped. So we got another question.
It is necessary for us to know what they're doing, and we don't know until the people at large tell us.
Absolutely. We don't know. On Halloween night, we do not know that they show up at your door with riot gear and demand to be let in, even when you're not under supervision, and they tell you that they'll arrest you. We don't know that till you let us know. And there's a lot of things that happen. We don't know until someone tells us. So we're going to go to another Colorado call. If anybody else has a question on can they do that, *6 will get you in the queue. I've got one from the internet I'm going to ask on the live stream, but we're going to take this voice call here. He's been waiting forever. 720, you are now on live Northland Action.
Well, yeah, there was some thoughts about that. anyway, my question is, so I'm on probation. I have 46 weeks left, and I was regressed from SIP 3 to SIP 1 for basically doing something that is statutorily protected. I don't want to get into details, but my thought has been, should I complete my probation, and then would I be able to sue the probation department after my probation is done?
This was a Colorado question. I don't know what your lawsuit would be about. I don't know what's statutorily protected. You just haven't given me enough detail to answer anything.
So basically what happened is, under Colorado 18.4.407, a merchant is allowed to detain someone who they reasonably suspect has stolen from them. I detained somebody by grabbing their shirt, and probation is screaming assault, 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 even though there's no actual police case, there's nothing.
Okay, so there's been no criminal charge filed against you for that?
No.
And no arrest?
No arrest.
I think the judge would laugh him out of the court.
It doesn't sound like
they have regressed me from a SIP 3 to a SIP 1 and are throwing numerous restrictions and everything on me. Took away all safety plans. Basically, I can go to work, I can go to therapy, and I can go to probation. That's all I can do anymore. Again, I'm wondering if I would have grounds to sue afterwards.
Wow. Well, this is a question for the Colorado lawyer, if I may. In some states, probation and parole has some autonomy to increase restrictions, and there was an attempt made like that in Louisiana, and it's questionable because generally conditions of probation are strictly set by the judge. How is that different in Colorado? Are they able to just unilaterally change his conditions and his freedoms in that fashion?
Absolutely. Full discretion as to the conditions of supervision is granted to probation. And to be honest with you, even when the conditions are unreasonable, oppressive, et cetera, the judges are very reluctant to step into that territory and order them to be changed. Certainly, if you can show that the conditions are arbitrary, if that they are unreasonable, you can petition the court, but you're not going to have any separate lawsuit where you can file it against probation after the fact. Really, your only course of action is to decide whether you want to ask the judge to modify those, and then you're going to have to start weighing that balance of is this the fight right at the end of your probation, unfortunately.
No. Under state law, I think, and not knowing Colorado, that seems to be the case, but I would think that for whatever limitation, applicable limitation period is, there is a deprivation of liberty without due process, as I see it, and probably the place to litigate that. We've concluded in Louisiana that the place to litigate any of the constitutional issues about registration is not state court. It is strictly federal courts with a life-tenured Article III judge. And so that seems like a possibility, but you would have a statute of limitations and you'd have to figure out what it is. And it would be a 1983 action because you would have to sue for damages, not for injunction, because if you sued for injunction, then the federal judge would say, well, first you have to exhaust your state remedies, and your state law remedies would probably get you nowhere. You'd waste a lot of time and money litigating that. So if you went strictly for damages and statutory attorney's fees under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 on the lack of due process, and I don't know what due process they give you. Does just the agent decide they can do that, or do you have administrative appeals? I don't know any of that, but it sounds pretty bizarre to me.
Ms. Burrell, you fight these battles. Did you have anything to add here in terms of this? Sounds very bizarre, and we've kind of lost.
You know, I don't do. Yeah, I don't do civil rights. I usually refer those out. But I would agree that if there's something that you think interferes with your daily activities, that you go to the judge and ask for a remedy. Your state court judge, but I don't know the consequences specifically of your case. But that's normally what we would do. We'd go ask for an exemption and say it wasn't reasonable. And then we can get a court order that way.
So, all right. Well, thank you for that question.
I do have one other thing for the lady who called first about her treatment provider. Something else to think about. The large treatment providers have a prescribed program, but if her husband switches to a smaller treatment provider, they can be a lot more flexible with their time. And so that might be, by switching treatment providers, that might be a way for her to get, for her husband to get done in his under 2 years.
Thank you for that. If that's an option, and I've put you back in mute, but you're still here with us. Thank you for the listening and for the question. We're going to take, I'm going to read an email, and then we're going to have Andy, who's managing the live stream, give us some questions from there. This is about the unfortunate situation in North Carolina, the storm. This is a verbatim I'm reading. I live in Brunswick County and received a voicemail that I could not shelter in any open shelter, in any open shelters that were schools. Schools were the only shelters listed in this area. My family and I have been forced to ride out Hurricane Florence in a mobile home. My crime was almost 20 years ago, and I'm not on probation or parole. This is so stupid. Know a guy from my area who murdered another man, and he's able to get into shelter with no problem. Wow. And that's from Wendell, and we agree with you. It's tragic. So, all right, Andy, did you want to start working the live stream, because we've got callers, but we've not taken anything from live stream.
Yeah, the one that I have is, if a person's sentence is from a foreign country and that determines the registry time in that country, is it punishment if a state makes you register there for life?
I guess, could you repeat the question, because I'm not exactly sure I'm understanding what it is.
Well, I think the person committed an offense in another country, and then here they are, and so whatever the numbers, say they had a 5-year registry requirement, but the state that they go to, they say that you have to register there for life. Is there any way to challenge that?
Well, the question was, is it punishment, right? And this is King. And that is the question. And that, you know, that is at the heart of all the ex post facto challenges and Alison Ruttenberg's Eighth Amendment challenge in Colorado. And that really, the answer to that question depends on the scheme of the state in question being punitive in fact. Either a punitive intent, there's the intent effects test. If you can find in the legislative history of the registration law that the legislature are doing this because they think that sex offenders deserve the worst things we can do to them, then that is punitive intent, and you don't have to prove punitive effect. If you don't have that, then you attempt to prove a punitive effect, which is in fact what has been done in several states, notably recently Michigan, but apparently Indiana recently too. And that would affect people with dates of offense prior to the changes in the law that were in fact considered punitive. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry. Wasn't the question if they came from another country?
Yes.
Jennifer, Ms. Burrell, I don't mean disrespect.
Well, we had an issue here where we had someone who was required to register in New Mexico and they moved to Mexico. And they tried to charge him with failing to register, but under New Mexico law, it only says if you move to another state. And we were able to convince the court that Mexico is not another state, it's a country, and as such, he wasn't required to register in Mexico. So I'm not sure which country you're coming from or the caller was coming from, but, you know, it would depend on what their law say. If they move out of the country, are they even required to register at all? And I think that's the biggest issue. We actually had him removed from the registry here.
Mm-hmm. And I've settled a case for someone who went back to El Salvador where there was no registry law. And that was an acceptable settlement for him. But I think she was talking about someone coming from a foreign country with a foreign conviction where it was a 5-year registry to a U.S. state where the registration was going to be for life. And is that punitive in itself? Well, no, not in itself. However, if that state laws, registry laws, are can be shown to be punitive, then that could be problematic. But I don't know that you have, whether or not you have ex post facto depends on the date of the offense. And then there is the Eighth Amendment angle, which is the one that's on appeal in the Tenth Circuit right now in Millard.
Well, that was what I was about to say. When people shift around the United States, what the foreign conviction is happening is pretty much the same thing. If you went from state to state, you could have a 10-year registration in Vermont, and you could move to New Mexico, and you could have a lifetime for that same offense. And that doesn't automatically make it punitive. You could go to 4 times a year reporting in New Mexico, and it was once a year by sending in a form in Vermont. That doesn't translate to punishment until you prove that that is punishment, because it is presumed to be non-punitive. And every attempt we've made, including one time where I testified as an expert witness in front of Judge Freddie Romero. Do you know him, Jennifer? I testified in front of Friendly Freddie as an expert on this matter, and we got nowhere with him, and we got nowhere with the Court of Appeals, and we got nowhere. The Supreme Court denied cert. So we got nowhere with that argument that our registry is punitive here. Until we prove that it's punitive, they can enhance your registration requirements. And I use the automobile example. If you take your old vehicle from New Mexico that's beyond the requirements to be certified for emissions, and you take that to a densely populated state like New Jersey, for example, they don't want to hear your sob story about New Mexico. It doesn't require you to have a smog inspection. Get that damn thing smogged if you want to put it on our streets here. We don't want, if you want to have it unregistered, take it back to where you came from. And that's the same thing about the registry. If you don't like the regulatory requirement that's imposed on you in one state, then you probably shouldn't be there, because it's a whole lot cheaper to go back to where you were and I'm not trying to be flippant, but if you're going to spend $50,000 on a legal challenge, or if you can live in a state where you mail in a form, that's an easy choice for me to make. I'm going to live in a state where I can mail in the form if that's an option. All right. Well, we're starting to close in on time on this segment, so let's try to get to the other callers. Do you have anybody else in the live stream that had a question, Andy?
They all passed by. I was busy, so no, not at the moment.
Well, I'll look through and see if I've missed them, because I'm trying to learn how to watch all these things. So we'll take another Colorado. No, let's do Oklahoma. We've done some Colorado calls. Oklahoma, 405. You're on Marcel in Action for Can They Do That?
Good evening. I was wondering if the paperwork shows that the treatment program here is required to be ordered by the court. For instance, my conditions of probation that the court gave me, there is a place for them to order treatment in addition to several other conditions of probation, and they did not order that treatment. Can probation still require me to participate in that?
I'm sorry, what state are you in?
When I was sentenced,
what state are you in? Are you talking about an Oklahoma conviction? Because you're calling from 405.
Oklahoma, yes, Oklahoma okay. conviction.
Okay.
I can't answer as to Oklahoma law and how that's set up, but in general, probation can impose certain conditions. Like I was saying, in Colorado, the judge always is going to leave it open where if probation decides something is necessary, and under Colorado law, it basically says that they can impose conditions that are reasonably related to your rehabilitation is the language. So if they can show that it's reasonably related, the judge will usually uphold that. Certainly if it's totally outrageous to suggest that you need to participate in treatment, then you could get a judge to order that you not have to participate.
Yeah, that's the same way in New Mexico too. We've had some, the basis of what the conviction is on can be very different from what probation thinks is a sex offender probation. And so there's been times where we've gone in and changed and told the court that it wasn't reasonably related and to anything that they pled to and been able to secure that. But I think probation has very broad discretion. And so unless it seemed as really unreasonable, that the court will allow it.
And for what it's worth, I tend to concur. And thank you for listening and for the call. Okay, we are going to now go to area code 720. You're now on Narcel in Action, and can they do that? Area code 720, you're on. And they probably have us muted, so we're going to come back to you, area code 720. We're going to take another call.
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, sir.
Okay. Am I okay to talk?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry. I was the one I called earlier about the, two cases that I was fighting, and I was asking about the grandfather law. That's what I was asking. I also wanted to know, where does the human rights and the civil rights fit in with all these laws that they're making? Because I've noticed through my 10 years and everything that I struggle with, that housing, it's like your constitutional rights are being stripped from you. And it's like, wait a minute, how am I supposed to have, I'm not even in a safe place. I have more going on that I would like to talk about that has happened to me since I have to been registered, because I had brutality by police officers. I've had children taken in the past. Through social services, and none of my stuff had to do with the child, and it's just, I don't understand why all this is going on, the human rights of it all, and the civil rights of it.
So it's like, hey, we're going to try to sharpen it down to a general question on that, and I'm going to put you in mute again, and thank you for listening for that question. Okay, who wants to take that? Because I know where he's going. He doesn't understand, and most people don't understand, how all these things can be done in a nation that holds itself out to be the model for civil rights. And we preach to the world about human rights, and yet we can so degrade a bunch of people. And that's where he's going with this, is how does that happen in the United States of America?
My comment would be is that, and this is King from Louisiana, is that the sex offender is in the 21st century is like the person suspected of witchcraft in the Middle Ages right through the 16th, 17th century. That's what it is. It is a societal hysteria. It is the exception to having to treat people decently. And it's one of those things that's going to go on until civil rights attorneys win the battle to roll that back and we see a societal change. That this is not a person who is permanently a monster. It is, this is, I resist someone being called a sex offender. It is a person in whose life something happened, and the thing that happened might have been no more than being accused. But even if they did the thing and they admitted they did the thing, still that doesn't mean that they are permanently dangerous. And the U.S. Supreme Court hinted in Packingham versus North Carolina last year that they're dismayed that people who have already served all of their sentences are subject to many onerous requirements and restrictions that are only based on the offense of conviction and not on any actual determination of individual dangerousness. And so that's great. I mean, it's a little slightly different Supreme Court who said that than the one we have now and that we're about to have. But let's hope it doesn't change in that respect, because 5 out of the 9 at that time, and it was a 9-0 opinion, but 5 out of the 9 joined the opinion that said that. And so that's my comment for now. It's a battle that we're in. We're seeing some advancement on it that's encouraging. And you are right to complain about it.
And it's also,
well, and I also think that, this is Jennifer, that, you know, we've got such a broad brush with that term, sex offender, you know, and if you had a consensual relationship with an adult and then they changed their mind and that's what your conviction was on, you know, try to keep you away from children doesn't seem rationally related at all. But we have seen a very large brush over these. And I think that's the scary part, is that we no longer look at individual facts and what's best for the person. You know, most sex offender programs through probation and parole are broad, and they don't look at what happened or what the facts of the case were in terms of trying to, you know, tailor what your conditions should be. And so that's a little scary. And I think those are things that we can actually work on in the legislature.
So any comment from Ms. Kelly?
Sure. And I agree that this is really unfortunate, and sort of, I think that people who have been designated quote unquote sex offenders are kind of some of the most marginalized people right now. And it's hard because they are called sex offenders, and that has such a negative idea in most people's head. And so there's such a lack of sympathy, right? When people are grouping everyone together and kind of discounting any of their rights because they're a sex offender. And that's the unfortunate thing that I'm seeing.
And we are approaching a hard break here, everyone. We're going to have a 5-minute intermission for you to stretch your legs and do your business. And we're going to come back for the final hour, where we're going to be talking about plea bargains and why do attorneys do plea bargains. And we're going to hopefully have some answers for everyone. So we'll see you on the flip side. You are listening to NARSL in Action.
Did you know that NARSL has podcasts?
Say what?
Yup, it's true. Just search your podcast app for NARSL and subscribe. You will automatically download the latest episodes of NARSL in Action, or Can They Do That, as soon as they are released. Or just take it old school and visit narsl.org/podcast.